This week, the Bitcoin bonanza continued, blasting higher to within earshot of 8,500, up 50% in just a few weeks. Well, welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczyk, here with you on this July 27th show with another two big guest interviews. Well, season 13, episode 654, we examine strong economic numbers that gave the dollar some buying power, putting the safe haven investments under pressure. But the technical picture seems to favor a bounce. Joining me in the discussion, first up, Louis Navalier of Navalier & Associates. He sees the best corporate earnings quarter he's seen in decades, 24%, and notes that gold and related shares deserve a place in everyone's investment portfolio. He shares several of his favorite stock candidates, so you'll want to listen in for all the ticker symbols and analysis. Then Bill Murphy from Gata.org rejoins me on the precious metals sector. He sees an endgame scenario that could unfold soon that could lead to an explosive move for the safe haven assets. We discussed the recent import taxes from Canadian lumber that have increased the cost of a new home construction domestically by about $9,000 per unit. The expenses passed along to the end purchaser. He thinks eventually the yellow metal will benefit from the dual risk of insidious inflation and economic stagnation, perhaps even global conflict. So you want to listen in to all the reports. And thanks to all of our Gold Seek Radio listeners and Alpha Stock subscribers, our five-year-old now has a little baby brother. As of this week, your support continues to help us keep the lights on in the studio. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear market commentary. The Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, extension number 514049. We'd like to field your questions and comments. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 641-715-3900. Please jot it down on a notepad or plug it right into your phone. Extension number 514049. It's that easy. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Cloudy skies persisted over the precious metals sector as investors turned to the U.S. dollar on strong U.S. GDP numbers Friday. Tame inflation plus strong growth suggests policymakers will pull the trigger on rate hikes at the September and December meetings. At the time of this recording, around 4 p.m., gold was off about $5, finishing around $12.25, really nearly break even. Silver ended down just 5 cents, also fractionally at $15.49 an ounce, while the XAU precious metal shares did give back a bit, down $2.74, 3.5%, ending at $76.83. But black gold bucked the trend after a 3-week slump, bouncing $1.35 to within earshot of $70. And the Bitcoin ETF stole the show, ticker GBTC. The Bitcoin Investment Trust picked up a dollar, 9% in a week, closing at 12, looking good. And the Tezos pre-tokens futures ended the week around break-even. The top story in the precious metals sector, data Friday indicated U.S. economic growth increased 4.1%, just shy of the 4.2% target of most analysts from April through June. That was the fastest pace in about 4 years. However, Market Watch and Wall Street analysts had expected stronger growth. The move gave the U.S. dollar some strength. In related news, domestic exports increased nearly 10%, driven mostly by an increase in soybean shipments due to the new trade tariff policies. One media source noted a soybean farmer in Pleasantville, Iowa, saw exports increase 50% in May from the year earlier, as trade tensions led foreign buyers to stock up on American products. Who'd have thought? Elsewhere, the FOMC meets next week to determine the benchmark overnight lending rate. Current Fed funds futures indicate virtually zero odds of a rate hike at the upcoming meeting, but 90% probability of a hike at the meeting slated for September, plus the December meeting, indicates nearly a 63% chance of a second quarter point rate hike. Bottom line on precious metals and Bitcoin. Clearly, the U.S. dollar was the key focus of investors this week. We had a small bounce, but still, the greenback remains in a multi-month trading pattern where it has really recoiled from resistance nearly 7 or 8 times. I think the onus of proof here really falls on the bull's shoulders. So we'll have to see if it can stage that rally next week. If not, the technical picture certainly looks like we're showing a bottoming pattern for the precious metals. So hopefully we can see that big pattern start to unfold just in time for the more seasonably favorable time of the year. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange on Friday as the blue chip Dow and S&P shrugged off the slump in the tech stock sector. At the time of this recording, around 4 p.m. Eastern, the Dow Jones added to last week's gains, adding an impressive 39 points, finishing over 25,000. And the S&P 500 was up fractionally at 2801, while the NASDAQ finished off 578 at 7820. The top story affecting U.S. equities, stocks revived by Friday on news that the president and EU president agreed to put off new tariffs during the negotiations. Plus, investors ignored the Facebook stock slump of 20% approximately. Losses amounted to $120 billion after warning that their revenue growth would be downgraded. Whereas tech titans Alphabet and Amazon reported earnings that blew past analysts' expectations, sending shares higher. Facebook logged the biggest one-day downturn in its capitalization ever on Thursday, while Intel and Twitter also followed on disappointing earnings numbers. U.S. shares, bottom line. Although the equities advance stalled somewhat this week, the seven indicator greed to fear index pendulum finally climbed to the greedy category, which perfectly coincides with waning momentum in the three indexes. I think this suggests a pullback is likely in the days and weeks ahead. However, there doesn't seem to be any change or shift yet in the primary bullish trend, so newer highs are likely and expected in the coming months. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Today's featured guest, Louis Navalier from Navalier Associates. Welcome back, Louis Navalier.
It's good to be here.
You know, we were talking before the show about the fact that so many major outlets have called the end of this bull market. It's almost the most hated equities market, certainly in the last 50 years or so. Maybe you can give us an overview of what's led you to this conclusion and what's driving this market higher.
Well, first of all, we have the best earnings environment I'll probably see in my lifetime. The first quarter earnings in the S&P were up 24%. The second quarter earnings are coming out now are forecast to be up over 20. The reason they decelerated when the economy actually accelerated is the dollar's strong now. So half the S&P sales are outside of America. So some companies have a currency headwind now, something like a John Deere, 3M, things like that. What's also going on is because the market's not going up as much as earnings, price-earnings ratios are being compressed, and companies are taking advantage of that and buying their stock back at their fastest pace ever recorded. That didn't get reported on CNBC for some reason. And, you know, CNBC's been very negative, and they, of their seven major markets, they lost, they fell second in six of their seven major market time slots. So they're now becoming more optimistic. Because they figured out if you're a poop head all the time, no one turns on the station. So it's a very mechanical rally. Earnings are working. It's time to be happy, grow and prosper. The tariffs are just trade negotiations. They're not impacting the economy. But they might impact the Fed. The Fed may use that as an excuse not to raise rates much. I expect one more Fed rate hike this year, but the Fed that we have now is very dovish.
I mean, if you look at the Fed funds futures at the St. Louis Fed, I mean, we're looking for a September hike. It's pretty much a sure bet, but they're still better than even odds of a December hike. You think they'll probably balk on that decision?
Yeah, half the guys on the Fed are doves. People like Charles Evans, Bullard, the St. Louis Fed, Neil Kashari, who's the Minneapolis Fed guy. The other thing is, as we raise rates, the rest of the world didn't, and that's why the currency is so strong. And finally, this guy, Jerome Powell, the new head of the Fed, he was handpicked by Treasury Secretary Mnuchin to be more market-friendly, and he's doing a good job. The Fed finally hit their inflation objective for the first time since 2011, when they want 2% inflation. but they don't want it to overheat the economy. But see, a surging dollar causes commodity prices to drop. So what's happened is...
You mentioned tariffs, taxes imposed on imports and exports around the world. Many of the nations involved are major trade partners. They are not pleased at all. But on the other hand, we're hearing that this is simply Washington's way of leveling the playing field after decades of unfair protectionist policies. What's your stance?
Well, I know Larry Kudlow. In fact, I was with him at a money show in early this year in the Orlando area. And, of course, I can't do money shows with him now because he's the national economic advisor. But I think he put it into perspective. The tariffs are there just to get fair trade. So if we had fair trade with Canada, we would not have that spat. For some reason, Canadian milk farmers aren't as efficient as U.S. farmers. So, I think we should told the Canadians, look, we'll send you to Wisconsin. We'll teach you how to be more efficient with your cows. And so we don't have to do these tariffs. But that's not what Canada wanted to do. So we had to impose more tariffs. When we export a car to Europe, they put a 10% tariff on it. When we export an SUV, they put a 25% tariff on it. When we import one of their cars, we have a 2.5% tariff. So those tariffs are 4 to 10 times higher than what we charge. So the goal of the tariffs is to basically get free trade everywhere and eliminate all tariffs. And right now the big fight is with China, because for every export dollar we export to them, we import $3.87. China keeps hitting a record trade deficit with us almost every single month. Obviously, it's not impacting the economy at all. Yeah, but it could eventually. The bears, the stores, the shelves at a Best Buy Walmart would be empty if we start to have problems with China. But I'm sure we'll resolve that diplomatically. President Trump's friends with President Xi, and I'm sure cooler heads will prevail. The government's going to get some revenue in the meantime. So nothing against these tariffs.
What else do you see as potential hurdles that U.S. equities have to overcome on a forward basis?
Well, we have to overcome what I call seasonality. I personally don't like August. New York's on vacation. So is Europe. We can have air pockets and problems. There can be some wild trading swings, but most of those should be viewed as good buying opportunities. We're telling our most conservative clients to be fully invested by mid-September. We tend to do well in quarter and window dressing. October is actually a pretty strong month for the market in the last 20 years. A lot of people remember October 87, but that was, again, 30 years ago. We'll have another good earnings season. Earnings are going to reaccelerate. And then everybody's happy around Thanksgiving. The best time to buy is the second week in November, because we always rally around Thanksgiving. We're in this huge small cap rally right now, and it's very, very impressive, because last year a lot of money was going into international emerging markets, multinational, because of a weaker dollar. Now with a strong dollar, everybody wants to be more domestic, more energy related. And so that money's really moving down the cap ladder, and a lot of this stuff is just melting up.
Moving on to the Navalier growth, we have the hold to buy list. These are upgrades, 73 upgrades at the most recent report. And I'd like to toss a few of these names and tickers to you and see if you are interested in commenting. First up, SunTrust Banks. Financial companies have been doing well. Ticker STI.
I pass on banks because I'm the next banking analyst.
Lockheed Martin Corporation, ticker LMT, bumped up from a C to a B. This is, of course, in the aeronautics space and perhaps benefiting from the threat of military expansion.
Yeah, and also great dividend growth. No, Lockheed's a solid stock.
Moving on to CSX Corporation, ticker CSX.
It's okay. It's a buy right now, but I prefer the trucking firms, Old Dominion, Knight.
Analog devices, ADI, B to a B.
It's okay. It's not as strong as I want it to be, fundamentally. My largest holding is NVIDIA, NVDA. That's the artificial intelligence chip company, the graphics chip company. They have beaten for 11 quarters in a row. It's pretty amazing what they've done, but we think they're a great buy right now. Another big holding of mine is Align Technology, ALGN. They make the Invisalign system to straighten your teeth. Apparently, people internationally really like straight teeth, so their sales are booming. We have a lot of very, very good energy stocks. A lot of them are in Latin America because of the Venezuelan issue. My favorite there would be EC. It's the Colombian oil company. We also like refining right now because the crack spreads are pretty wide. Our favorite refining pick would be Valero.
I mean, even this studio workstation right here has two GPUs, a couple of them more recent, Zotac GPUs, and this is really big in mining, which took a hit after a big year in 2017, but their GPU division, from my perspective, is big, and not just for mining, but for research, as you pointed out. Plus, I've never seen a company with beta and off-the-chart alpha like NVIDIA. When you put it on the efficient curve there, the efficient frontier, it can make any portfolio look like it has a great expected return on it. So, did forget to mention the precious metals. You know, as long as U.S. equities are hot, can you find anything positive to say? Maybe the shares might perk up?
I think gold's been hurt by the surge of Bitcoin and all these cryptocurrencies, but I think a lot of people are more comfortable with gold. So I think gold will be fine long term. You just need to have people being secure. You know, the zero interest rates around the world help a lot too. I think gold still deserves an allocation. It's just we have to wait for the mushroom cloud or something to appear. So I think all this talk with Iran is good, and you know, Israel just shot down a Syrian jet today. So
I sometimes wonder, crypto's competing with gold, if that really isn't a non sequitur, because cryptos seem to be more of an alpha play or a speculative play, and even tying in with the big success we've seen in the NASDAQ, at least from my perspective, like 1995, 96, internet.com frenzy underway, more so last year, obviously, than this year. But as for a direct competitor as a safe haven, wouldn't you at least concede that there are an awful lot of security issues and lack of understanding by the mainstream public about crypto and cryptography to really give Bitcoin that safe haven play for most people?
Yeah, but I know a lot of people from different countries. So, you know, people in Venezuela have been forced to use cryptocurrencies because their currency is worthless. Same with Zimbabwe. You know, there's more cell phones than bank accounts. So that's where it took off there. I'm from Berkeley, California originally, and I know some people in the marijuana business, and they've always done it. I think the biggest threat to the cryptos are the hacking. So we got to watch North Korea. They've always been a big counterfeiter of our currency, and now they have 7,000 full-time hackers. So they seem to be more obsessed with hacking the South Korean exchanges. I'd hate to see them
From my perspective, the bigger concern, and maybe this is a topic for a different show, is the quantum computing, the rise and really ascension of quantum computing. Qubits, as opposed to our computing that we're working with right now, really allows for such an exponential ability to crack cryptography. For instance, if I had access to a quantum computer, you know, it'd set you back about $5 to $10 million. But if I had access to one, which you really do, by the way, through IBM, and knew how to program qubits, I would crack open Satoshi Nakamoto's wallet that has nearly 1 million Bitcoin in it. It wouldn't take too long with a quantum computer if you were a genius programmer. The quantum computer could really upset the work that's underway right now in the crypto arena.
Well, it may be underway.
And I also liked your comment on Venezuela. I don't know why this doesn't get more press, but I just read an article last evening that Maduro is now anticipating 1,000,000% inflation.
I'm in South Florida. We have a lot of Venezuelans here. They moved to Weston and Doral. In fact, that Trump club is dominated all around by Venezuelans as a Venezuelan restaurant. But the whole country is set up to extort, okay? So you join the military, you extort money, and then you move to Florida, apparently. It's kind of an interesting society, but the drug trade is definitely going to Venezuela now. So as Colombia got better and better, the drug trade went to Colombia. It's really horrific what's happened. You know, now they can't feed their soldiers. You know, I actually had a caddy when I was playing golf in Alabama. I had to go back. He just finished his college degree, and he was obviously playing college golf. And he's going to go back, but, you know, he knows he's not going to come back for a while. We were interesting times, but something's going to happen because we've been having a lot of meetings down there, and that could be ex-grenade.
You're probably familiar with Tim Draper, Silicon Valley billionaire and Bitcoin enthusiast. He was on the show, mirrored so much of your thoughts. He had a close family friend from that region in South America who had three times watched his family fortune evaporate, whether it be gold stolen from vaults or stocks eliminated or mostly the currency just completely collapsing or being devalued. That really turned him on to Bitcoin. He moved his entire family fortune out of the region, out of the country, to, as you mentioned, and that just struck a chord with Tim Draper, who then, as we all know now, invested heavily in Bitcoin at $500. Is something, I guess, that can maybe happen anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, chaos reigns. I mean, when you go around the world, the reserve currency is definitely the dollar. But it, these cryptos can be an alternative. So they have some stumbling blocks. The IMF's not a big fan of them, although they did get the Malta exchange. I have friends in Malta, so they're watching it pretty carefully. But the other thing that's happened is, you know, the Fed wants nothing to do with them. Jerome Powell says, I don't want to regulate it. Now, our Treasury has declared it an asset.
Officially, you are right. Regulators are mostly taking on a hands-off approach. There's a lot of dissension among the ranks. Is it an asset? Is it a currency? They really don't know. They can't decide. But, you know, there are some holdouts in the Fed. I heard someone from the St. Louis say, wait a minute, we need to take a closer look at this. This looks and smells an awful lot like a currency in direct competition with the U.S. dollar. And I personally agree with that viewpoint and believe that eventually, we may be talking 10 years from now, will become a de facto reserve currency of its own. Can you tell folks a little bit more about the services you provide?
Sure. Well, there's two things we do. We have a newsletter business. I would encourage everybody to go to NavalierGrowth.com, which is the newsletter site. We have our free stock rating there. Sign up for it. We also have a management company, Navalier.com. We keep those businesses separate, but, you know, we do manage accounts and mutual funds. And we have a big bond business. We do a lot of things. We're happy to help people, but all our sites have free stock graders, free dividend graders. And so you might want to go see how your stocks rank on our system and get to know us. We also have free commentary on Navalier.com.
All right, Louis Navalier, we want to thank you for your time, as always.
Same to you. Take care.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Just a pleasure to welcome back Bob Hoy, formerly of Institutional Advisors and now the editor-in-chief, investment strategist of chartsandmarkets.com. I bet you didn't think I'd remember that, Bob Hoy.
You got it down. We changed the name of the business.
Exactly. And you were saying the weather more delightful today.
how about 71 degrees, no breeze. Now, I'm only about 1,000 feet away from the ocean, so I look down into the called Georgia Strait, and then across the strait, the mountains on Vancouver Island. So, and actually, on the edge of the cliff going down the ocean, there's a some very tall old fir trees, and one of them is blasted out on the top, and it's got little stubbed branches. And oftentimes there'll be two eagles perched there, but this morning there's just one. But everything's great.
Well, I can't say that our view here from this home in North Carolina is nearly as breathtaking, but, you know, we do have seasonal, nearly 300-degree panoramic views of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Through the city, we've got urban coyotes, urban raccoons.
Mm-hmm.
We've got urban skunks. We have urban socialists.
We have another rare breed, the urban possum. Moving on here to the topic du jour, the potential inversion, the flattening of the yield curve. Today, the yield curve is the flattest it has been in 11 years. This according to Michael Schneider, and he does a great job trying to bring to the attention of North Americans the significance of the yield curve, because most people, their eyes will gloss over if you bring up this idea of the three-month note and two-year note and the five and the 10-year bill. The yield curve is perhaps one of the most important indicators of a recession. It's predicted every single recession since the 1960s.
Got the yield curve back to 1857.
Well, there you go. Our current Fed chief, Jerome Powell, is disinterested in the yield curve. The flattest the yield curve has been in over a decade. And what that means is, by the end of this year, or perhaps early 2019, we could get that dreaded inversion. Tell people the significance of this for the markets, please.
Yeah, well, what it is short rates get bid up faster than long rates because there's a speculative demand for short-term stuff, you know, leverage, margin at the brokerage, and the equivalent everywhere. It's as old as the hills. Now, the thing about central banking is that when the yield curve gets pushed enough and reverses, there's nothing the senior central bank can do about it. So the issue is not flattening, which it has been doing. It's when it changes, and that's the problem. Now, the other thing that goes with that, Chris, is that short rates go up, like T-bills, and they've risen to a little over 2% from next to nothing on the 3 months. The typical type of commentator out there who says, oh, rising interest rates, awful. Short rates going up and the curve flattening confirms that the boom is on. And so long as it's on, it's on. But now, in 2007, we looked at it, and in late 2006 it was, I think, it briefly actually inverted. We're looking at the fives to the 30s. And then it spent most of the time, like 20 beeps under. And this is where it's been recently, come into about 19, 20 basis points from inversion. Now, also with our chart going back to 1857 on the yield curve, there are times when you went into a bear market and recession when the curve didn't fully invert. So inversion's not necessary. The key is the change in direction. Now, maybe last week the flattening, and it's now coming back a bit. But on this one, we expect that the bank stocks would benefit in the first of turning to steepening, but the event of turning to steepening is a very good indicator of going into the contraction. And then the credit markets, the other one that is good too, is the credit spreads, which is the difference between high-grade bonds and low-grade bonds. And then in a period of confidence that you have with a boom, everybody's reaching for yield and overlooking risk, and the spreads have narrowed until about 5 or 6 weeks ago when they've made an attempt to reverse. Now, technically, this is not reversed yet, but it's done what we call the first breakout on an attempt to turn to widening. And in the past, like 2007 or 2000, it was the second attempt to widening that really became critical. And in 2007, that was accomplished by late August, and then the high in the stock market on the S&P was the middle of October. So we're watching it closely, and the beauty of it, Chris, is that the Federal Reserve can do nothing about it because it's a change by the public from the demand for speculative money. And when that changes, it shows that speculators are changing themselves, and it can be a subtle change. And then, as we know, the Austrian school is headed up by von Mises has said a very simple one, and that is that at the top of a boom for the contraction, the bankers don't have to call in the loans. All they do is get a bit nervous and stop making them. So here we are, watching for the curve and the credit spreads to change direction. And you can't make a decision on it till they actually have accomplished the change, but we're in the period when they could likely change. You remember earlier in the year, Chris, we were talking about sunshine in the credit markets, and the sunshine could run into about June, which it has done. And then we had some fun with the play on words and get into twilight in August, and then the full twilight zone in the fall where we could face a liquidity crisis. Take a look at it from an investor's point of view, owning investment-grade stocks, and he thinks he's safe. But the problem is that speculators have bid these things up to speculative highs, and you can talk about price-earnings multiples, but stock analysts are there to come up with a forecast on earnings that'll rationalize the urge to buy stock at high prices. And so the one we look at is the S&P relative to wages, the average wage, and it's exceptionally high, or was at the turn of the year. And another one that's good is relative to the GDP, because, you know, again, the economists can come out with changes in GDP forecasts, but it's pretty real. And then another one you look at is the ratio between growth stocks and investment stocks. Well, that then one is up to as high as it was in 2007. So a few ways of looking at it rationally say that the market is overpriced, similar to what it was in 2007 as the last instance. Again, we use our tried and true methods. The other one that was part of the sunshine, Chris, that was helpful coming out of the hit at the first of the year was that we expected industrial commodities like base metals and lumber, crude oil, to rally out to around May, and they did, and they've been hit hard. So that's a big warning, particularly copper has taken quite a drop. So that was the other one. So altogether, we called these, beyond using the term sunshine, we called them friends of the bull market. And the only two friends left are in the credit markets where you still got short rates going up. And as I said, the curve is still flattening and spreads, well, they have widened for or have narrowed for a bit. But anyways, they are not as yet negative. But the base metals and industrial commodities, they are very negative. So, and then the other thing on these industrial commodities is you can often have a good low for lumber in October of the year, copper often a low in November, and crude oil often a low in November, December. So you're looking at seasonal lows. And the other ones I looked at, you know, the exotics, like cobalt and lithium, they are now in bear markets. And I took a look at vanadium, and it's sort of toppy, I guess, but maybe we have to look some work on that one. But as I said, the exotics have headed south as well. So you have to really look at what these basics are telling us. And then you kind of get, whereas if you listen to the economists or the central bankers, or what I'm hoping to see is that I think, without measuring, I think there's more talk about the yield curve now than at any time that I can recall. So people are looking at it. Now, the other thing is that some of the big brokerage firms are a little more astute than they used to be when actually research was dominated by the underwriting department, and all they wanted was good write-ups on the stock that they'd underwritten. So the big brokers have moved a little more sophisticated, but you can take a look at one of their 30-page studies on one thing, and what a waste of time. Whereas what we do is, in four pages, cover the key things on whether you're going to make money in the bond market, or you're going to make money in commodities, or you're going to make money in stocks. And been doing it for decades, and it works for us, and it works for our subscribers.
Well, wouldn't the medieval monk Occam be impressed?
Occam's razor, yeah. He was a man, he was an Oxford man, and was one of the highlight intellectuals in a period within the church when scholasticism was a problem. And these guys were very clever, very bright men, and they debated all sorts of theological things forever. That was their job. But you had standouts like Occam, who really rose above it. And outside of the church, of course, was Copernicus, and then eventually you had Kepler. Occam was back in the 1300s, I think, and then you had
Johannes Kepler.
You know, he was the leading mind who figured out the orbits, that they were elliptical.
Yes, he did, but he did it mathematically, too, which was interesting.
Guess what? At the time, the government wanted to hear his forecasts based upon astrology. So solving the orbits of the solar system was fantastic, but what government wanted was some forecasts on what they were doing based on astrology.
Don't forget Tycho Brahe, the meticulous note-taking, his empirical observations that he drew from the constellations in the heavens that actually facilitated the mathematical theories of Kepler. You noted that it was government and the needs that they had that drove much of the great scientific breakthroughs. Well, take a look at Galileo Galilei. He, of course, at the time sold his refracting telescope to the government so that they could look for ships on the horizon several hours ahead of their arrival and protect the country or the city-state from invading forces. If you were, let's say, a bondholder or a shareholder of a particular company on a particular route, and you could see that your ships were arriving several hours ahead of the other people at the exchanges, that gave you a great advantage as well. And I like how Occam's razor can cut out the hyperbole and get us just to the facts. I'd like to return, though, to this concept of the yield curve and just how significant it is, because I want all of our listeners, even those who are new to the show, to get a really solid feel for the significance of the yield curve, but on a very basic level. So banks borrow in the short term. This makes sense. And then they lend to people, for, let's say, for a mortgage or a business loan, anywhere from 10, 20, 30 years or more. So they profit from the difference between them, because the longer the loan you have, the higher the interest rate, because there's more volatility and there are many unknowns in the future. So it just increases the yield. Whereas the shorter term, we have a better feel for what's coming down the pike, you have lower rates in general. You know, as long as that gap between long and short is relatively significant, it predicts the profitability of the financial institutions and their ability to remain solvent on their obligations. However, as that gap starts to narrow, as we're seeing the most narrow yield in over 10 years, and this, of course, is the proxy that the Fed looks at and the other banking institutions, profitability begins on average to decline significantly. And then when you have an inversion, it can become much more challenging for financial institutions. And keep in mind that the financial institutions tend to lead the economy, usually a leading indicator, at least of the stock market. So why don't we run with this idea, and you can help people understand the significance of this lending proxy and why everyone needs to keep an eye on it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's called borrowing short and lending long. And they've been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. And even, say, example, in the 1720 South Sea bubble, you could borrow from the senior, well, the Bank of England then at 5%, and you could get the equivalent of 20% on call, and the equivalent of a call market. So it gets very compelling. And then the 1825 bubble, there's a note, it just the arithmetic of borrowing short and lending long is so compelling, and then everybody plays it to the hilt, and then it goes the other way. So what happens in a bubble is everything gets speculated, and when the curve reverses and is matched by credit spreads widening, that the senior central bank, although it poses as being in charge by raising short rates, it's just following market rates of interest, and it will eventually. So the irony is that the Fed really thinks it's running things, and when the Fed was formed and first opened the doors in January of 1914, the theme then was that the Fed would prevent nasty setbacks in the financial markets that always preceded recessions. Great theory, but there's been 18 recessions since the Fed opened its doors in 1914. So the theory's there, but it never works. And here we are again, a classic spreads flattening and the curve narrowing, and there's nothing that the Fed can do about it. And we would remind people of that seasonally, we're in the time of year when these credit markets can change. So we watch them very closely.
I think the key takeaway point here, you can ignore all the rest, forget all the terms. As we start to see this unfold, and we expect it to continue, almost all of our top guests here agree with us that we're going to see this become a more and more mainstream concept in the next 6 to 12 months. What people need to keep in mind is it is just becoming more and more expensive for businesses and institutions to lend. And as that lending becomes curtailed, businesses find it difficult to expand. When it's harder to expand and meet obligations, you see increases in layoffs, slowed production, start to see increases in unemployment, you start to see declines in corporate profits. Add this all up and you have lower economic output and quite possibly a significant decline in interest in U.S. shares. But we're also seeing a flattening of the yield curve in Japan, as well as Europe and around the world, because we're so interconnected, I'd say more so than ever before.
The credit markets are global. What you have here is that the Fed has never prevented the reversal in these credit markets that sets off a contraction. Now, the other thing that in old days, before we got into this world of financial inflation and financial assets, the stock market would go up and get overbought and head down. But the economy would be still generating good news, because often a peak in the stock market would be about 12 months ahead of the peak in the economy. But when you're in a world of inflation and financial assets, the changes are virtually together. Like, for example, the stock market peaked in October 2007, and then the NBER decided that the recession started that December. And then if you go back to 1929, the stock market peaked in that fateful September, and the NBER decided that the economy peaked in that August. And then there's one more great financial bubble that was covered by the recession work that done by the NBER, and that was the bubble of 1873, which in New York peaked in, guess what, September. And that recession started in that October. And then by 1884, senior economists in England looked at how relentless the contraction was and said, and started calling it the Great Depression. And that Great Depression ran from 1873 to 1896. And then you had senior economists in England again, Rothschild was one of them, as late as 1939, was still analyzing the Great Depression of 1873 to 1895 and how it could have been prevented when they're in the midst of then the Great Depression that started in 1929. So the world of financial asset inflation is very different from normal times, and we are in a world of financial asset inflation, and when it turns down, the economy quite likely will head south instantly with it, as it did in 2007. So we live in very interesting times.
One little proviso, though. Take a look at 2007, 2008. I mean, it was obvious that a housing collapse was coming. At the time, my former mentor, Bob Chapman, and I, we were just pounding the table more than I think any other pundit, as CNBC was convinced it was the best housing market buying opportunity in decades when we were just off less than 2 or 3% from the peak Case-Shiller index. We were saying this is going to be a wholesale rout like we've never seen before. And then the very next day, Ben Bernanke, the chairman, Fed chairman at the time, actually made a call, I think, on CNBC to Maria Bartiromo, if memory serves. He said something to the effect of, I don't buy your premise. There has never been a housing collapse. His comments echo in infamy, you know, today.
He didn't know what happened to real estate in the U.S. after 1928.
If you study history, financial and economic history, Jesse Livermore was actually speculating in the Florida housing bubble at that time.
On property values in a depression, the only one I could find back away was in England in 1873, and I came across a chart of farmland values. And it peaked with the bubble in 1873 on, you know, annual average numbers, and went all the way down to the end of the Depression in 1896. Not one year did it even go sideways. So farmland values in that Great Depression went down, and quite likely most values for property in the next contraction will go down.
I have some excellent contacts at the major financial publisher, John Wiley and Sons, the editor, directors, and all the contacts there.
Good way of going about it. I know there's a book here, and all I have to do is get it out. And that then it takes a special effort, which I should do. I had wanted to actually to have published one a few years ago, but the pressures of business and writing weekly. You're right, to take a certain amount of time each day and work on a chapter.
Even if it's just 15 minutes, put it aside from your newsletter work and all the rest. If you ever want to read a book that I think you could mirror, it was really Bernstein's classic, Against the Gods. Anyone who loves financial history must pick up Bernstein's Against the Gods. And he brings so many fascinating anecdotes from history. Why don't you give us an overview of what this inverted yield curve plus the nascent trade war that we're seeing unfold. Could this sort of converge into a perfect financial storm?
Yeah, it can, Christy. But first of all, Trump is trying to ease the protectionism that has existed for a long time against the United States. And remember, I'm saying this from Canada. But in every post-bubble contraction, the turn has been that in each country, each government is facing unemployment and hardship, and they do the natural, which is protectionism, because they got to look after their own electorate. So there will be, now, the best one for a name followed the 1825 bubble, and the U.S. came in with what was called the Tariff of Abominations. So how bad is that going to be? And it'll happen. It's the way it works. Each politician domestically has to look after unemployment, and there will be economists who will say, go to protectionism. But at the moment, Trump is not moving to protectionism. He's trying to reduce it against the U.S., and I back him on that. So
I'd like for you to give our listeners today an idea of just how these series of events might impact U.S. shares, the precious metals, and even the not-so-precious metals, commodities, for instance. Crude oil, which is an interesting rogue element showing its own signs of life between the CRB, the Commodities Index, and crude oil lately. And then the U.S. dollar, which is acting peculiarly as well.
In a bubble where we have been, industrial commodities in real terms deflated, go up. They're not going up anymore. And in the same bubble, the real price of gold deflated by the CPI goes down. It did. It declined from 2011 to 2017, and it's been going flat since. And in the contraction, this reverses where real prices of base metals go down for a long time, and the real price of gold goes up for an equally long time, making the industry very profitable. So every Great Depression, the leading industry that you can analyze has been gold mining. And the way it works, Chris, is that in a bubble, you have a huge expansion of credit that can't be serviced, and you have also a huge expansion of fanciful credit, you know, all kinds of derivatives and imaginary stuff. Well, all of that contracts, and as the real price of gold goes up, that's the way Mother Nature begins to reliquify the system. The real price goes up, the producers produce more of it, it goes into the banking system and starts to restore liquidity. And so the irony has been, is that I mentioned about the Great Depression that ended in the late 1890s, and that was then at the end of a 20-year bull market for gold's real price and a long period of high unemployment. So what do you get? Gold very attractive and a whole lot of unemployed men going looking for it. So every great gold rush has occurred close to the bottom of a Great Depression. That was the case in California in the 1840s as well. That was a Great Depression bottom. So here's the theme. Most stock sectors down, including gold stocks, and then out of the storm, you'll end up with a long bull market for the gold sector, and it eventually will become highly speculative and a lot of fun, junior mines moving, the whole thing. But that's ahead of us, and the entry is going to be difficult, and this is where you want to have a subscription to a service that knows what's going on.
It's interesting you'd mention that, because if you look at the bottom of the U.S. equities mini crash, I guess, of the year 2000 down to 2002, 2003, that was really the genesis, I think you'd agree, of the 12-year gold bull market. Coincides almost perfectly with your idea that the bull markets in the precious metals tend to follow carnage and chaos in U.S. equities and in the economy as a whole. And tell us a little bit more about charts and markets, what people can find.
Find just chartsandmarkets.com or just me, bobhoy.com, and that'll take you straight into the site. And we've got some very good charts in the history there, plus explanations. And we can, each week's main piece covers the key items. We'll enjoy people checking out our service. Okay, Chris, next time. Yep.
Talk soon. Bye bye.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Censorship is something that, in a free society, can never be tolerated. Disagreements are permitted. Arguments are permitted. But violence and outright eradication of differing points of view can never be tolerated. I've discussed before how the people and algorithms controlling some search engines will actively attempt to rewrite history by repositioning certain topics and themes to the bottom of search results in the hopes those discussions, no matter how popular and relevant, will simply go away. One example I have cited before, which has significant implications in the financial world, is how I am unable to locate anywhere on the internet the actual video interview George Stephanopoulos gave several days after 9/11 in 2001, when he appeared on Good Morning America and explained in detail the plunge protection team, and how the president and certain cabinet officials could manage the stock market through what's called the president's working group on financial markets. This is just one example of how important pieces of our history disappear. Yes, there are accounts of the interview, but not the interview itself. If I've missed it, I'd like to ask our listeners to email me a link. The email address is office@conquerchange.com. I've requested this information before, but not one listener has ever emailed the requested link. Information that is excised from the web is a form of direct censorship. It's disguised under the argument that private companies do this, so there's no recourse. Or it's included in their terms of service, so it must be permissible. Often when people hear these talking points to justify out-and-out censorship, they silently say to themselves, well, I guess that's okay, as these arguments somehow appeal to the last vague notions that some people have of free market capitalism. But censorship is censorship, and regardless of what social media platform or search engine is doing it, it's fundamentally and diametrically opposed to free thought and free speech. Even if you disagree with that thought or speech, and yes, even if you are uncomfortable or offended by it. Digital censorship in the name of ambiguous community guidelines and other such unsubstantiated and ambiguous reasons put forth to eradicate thought, discussion, and direct peer-to-peer communication must be pushed back against swiftly and consistently. Because if you fail to push back, you will find in the not too distant future that your ability to speak and your ability to not only disseminate information, but view it as well, may be curtailed in ways you haven't even imagined yet. What will you do when the tide turns? And instead of going after content creators on YouTube, for example, like the termination of the SGT report this week, the viewers of content, any content that is deemed fake, inappropriate, not meeting undefined community guidelines, or not in sync with a particular point of view, what if those consumers of information that is deemed off-limits have their internet connections blocked, filtered, or terminated, or their cell phone service non-renewed? Think it can't happen? Think again. If you wait to do something about it until then, the battle is already lost, along with freedoms you never really appreciated or understood. The battle for your mind is the final frontier. Those who are vying for it will stop at nothing to control what you think, what you say, and to whom you communicate that information. The only person that should have control over what you think, discuss, and disseminate is you. You are the ultimate censor. You have an off button and an ability to block information you don't want to receive. As much as others are trying to seize that ability from you, me, and everyone else, that ability can never be delegated to others. It must remain with you. It is your responsibility. You are ultimately responsible. Because at the end of the day, the only safe place you are entitled to is the one you create yourself. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.